Investor Brand Network, IBN, a multifaceted communications organization engaged in connecting public companies to the investment community, is pleased to announce the launch of the Stock to Me podcast as part of its sustained audio communications effort to provide specialized content distribution via widespread syndication channels. The following Stock to Me podcast is an Investor Brand Network audio production and may feature a client partner of IBN. Investor Brand Network may have been compensated for the production of this podcast. Please be sure to read our entire disclaimer for full disclosure. Thank you, and here today is your host of the Stock to Me podcast.
Welcome to the Stock to Me podcast. I'm your host, Stuart Smith, and I am truly excited about our guest today, and here's why. He's the best-selling author of Pitch Anything, an innovative method for presenting, persuading, and winning the deal, as well as Flip the Script, getting people to think your idea is their idea. Oren Klaff, our guest today, is one of the world's leading experts on sales, raising capital, and negotiation, and he's raised over $2 billion in investments for his companies. Oren's the director of capital markets at investment bank Intersection Capital, and he is our guest today. I know you can find Oren on his YouTube channel, at his Twitter, at pitchmastery.com, and the list goes on, so do yourself a favor, Google Oren Klaff, K-L-A-F-F, and now let's meet the man. Oren, thanks for taking the time to call in.
Well, of course, Stuart, I'm just here to steal your radio voice to learn from you how to be so eloquent and well-spoken and communicate with that strength of character. Beautiful, beautiful introduction.
I sure do appreciate that. That's some heady praise coming from you. Of course, I've done my due diligence following you and seeing your other videos. It's been an education, and I guess that's really my first question, Oren. Being as prolific as you've been, what was the motivation for you to put pen to paper and start with Pitch Anything? And then, of course, you followed that up with another page turner, Flip the Script. Let's talk a little bit about your motivation.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think if I go way back to when Pitch Anything was written, the financial world had stopped turning on its axis. We were all completely shut down in 2008. We do deals. Deals require debt. If any of you are old enough to remember 2008, some of you are, some of you aren't, Stuart. Financing wasn't available. So there was no debt, no deals. And so there are a couple hundred of us in the deal business looking for something to do. I spoke at conferences, a couple radio shows, Howard Stern people were talking to me because I have a good personality. I'm charismatic. I know what I'm talking about. I've done a lot of deals. So I've been on some radio shows and just stumbled into a publishing house and an agent. And the agent said, man, I'd love to take you to McGraw-Hill and Simon & Schuster. And she took me around in New York, and it was just a thing. And then McGraw-Hill said, we'd love to have you write a book. And then they gave me a check. And so there wasn't really a motivation, just I wasn't doing anything else. And some people were writing poetry, some people were painting. You know, these hardcore finance guys doing $100 million deals. And now they're restoring a Camaro in their garage. They're writing poetry. They're learning to play the guitar. And for me, you know, because there's no deals going on, I wrote a book.
Well, you know what? I tell you what, we share that in common. Howard Stern, the master interviewer himself, what a motivation for both of us. And I'm an accountant by trade, and here I am today doing this as well. So, Oren, I want to talk about that evolution then that happened inside of you as well, though, because look, bottom line is circumstances can push us in directions, but we have to take that leap of faith. We've got to make the move. You had the guts and the gusto to do everything you've done to date. The motivation then and the evolution of yourself to then write Flip the Script. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Well, I think let me wind back to Pitch Anything. So McGraw-Hill said, hey, you know, here's some money, write a book. And I go, great, you know, I'll spend 30 days, 6 weeks, whatever, writing a book. And you know, after 6 weeks, I'd written, you know, but soft, what light through yonder window breaks, 'tis at the dawn. I mean, it was a dark and stormy night, right? It was about what I'd written after 6 weeks. And so they had to come in and get me a professional, you know, somebody to help me structure the book, and then 6 months had gone by and I'd finished chapter one. So a book is something that you think is going to go very quickly. I have a very famous friend who was a screenwriter for Hunted and Collateral Damage, a guy named David Griffiths, and very well-known screenwriter. And I said, you know, hey, David, I wrote 2,500 words today. The whole book only has to be 60,000. At this rate, I'll be done in the first month. And he said, Oren, that's fantastic. You wrote 2,500 words today? That's great. I said, yeah, I'm really excited. He said, do me a favor. Go back and read them.
Yeah, that's a big test.
So you can't write 2,500 words a day, you know, of a book. It's maybe 350, 500 words a day, you know, or every 2 days if you're lucky. So this thing took up a year. It was only supposed to take a month. So it's not like, hey, what made you decide to write a book? You didn't have anything else to do. They gave me some money. I said, I'll take a month, write a book, whatever. But then it ended up, you know, you're going to put your name on it. By the work, one knows the workman. And so it was never good enough. But in the end, I did spend a full year on Pitch Anything. And now a million people have taken that and changed their own life, how they pitch, how they raise money, how they get deals done. So if you invest the time in whatever you're creating and really make it something that other people can clone you, duplicate you, do what you do, it's worth the investment. So then, you know, years later, they came back around and said, hey, would you like to do a second book? And I said, oh, a second book? No. If you remember, the first book took a year, right? And they're like, yeah, but it's a second book. Now you know how to write a book. You get all this material. It won't take you any time at all. So my agent talked me into it.
Well, I'm glad they did, because it has changed a lot of people's lives. The reviews are, once again, absolutely tremendous reviews for your work and how you've changed people. But it also, you really have to practice what you preach. You are still working there at Intersection Capital. And throughout your career, I know you've witnessed people make the same mistake over and over again, because there's the book. And then there's the human element. And the human element says, how are we going to take what we've read and incorporate it into our lives and change ourselves based on reading the landscape that Oren has laid out for us in his book? So your work with Intersection Capital, and throughout your career, you've seen these mistakes being made. You've seen how people just get, you know, through that first meeting, they can't get the second or the third. They're doing it wrong. And so you were generous enough to lay out the land for them and tell them, hey, this is the way you do it.
I think this is the issue. There's a general sense of, if I'm going to pitch for money, I'm going to go sell something. I can basically put together my offer, get some features and benefits squared away, get 10 slides, 20 slides, 40 slides, whatever, walk people through it. We're good people. We have a good product and a service. We have a good reputation, lots of customer logos, or, you know, we're well known. We're going to tell people what we have. We're going to make them an offer. We're going to give them the features and benefits, and offer to fix their problems or deliver a return on investment for them. What else can we do? Right? And that's the winging it approach. So that is the absolute, probably bare minimum or below bare minimum. And so there's no sense of people, you know, in general business, of getting in front of an audience, getting in front of a buyer, getting in front of an investor is a real thing. The way surgery is a thing, the way that preparing tax returns for a complex multi, you know, LLC organization, the way that operating a factory, the way that doing electrical engineering, giving a pitch is as detailed, as complicated, and there are as many places to go wrong as there are in surgery, in tax returns, in engineering. And until you pass this notion that this is something that is done professionally at a very high level on Wall Street, in Silicon Valley, by certain firms, until you understand that, and that you winging it, getting in front of people and giving some presentation you put together in your office, is not in any way at the level that other people are performing. When I come up against you, I will take your customer away. When I come up against you in a deal, I will take your investor away. Candy from a baby. And so there is a level of professional know-how and understanding and engineering that goes into a presentation, there's framing, there's status, there is a packaging of ideas, there is time frames, power frames, and all these things working below the surface, you're not, most people are not even aware are functioning. So in both those books, I laid out what is really happening in a meeting and what a professional would do. So by the way, Stuart, did you ever see the show Pros versus Joes?
I sure did.
Incredible, because you they take these guys that are the Joes, and these guys are, the Joes are who you want to be, right? Like they play on regional football leagues, they work out every day, they can run, the kind of guys that can go on American Ninja, right? But, you know, they're 5'10", 6'1", they're 185 pounds, 205 pounds, right? Then they put them next to the pros, real professional athletes, and they get eaten alive. It's laughable, right? And so in some sense, I love that metaphor or that show, because we tend to think we're pros when we're really Joes.
And you won't know until you come up against a pro, right?
Yeah. I mean, there are guys who would just eat you for lunch because they're professionally trained. There's just no way to back into this stuff. You've got to be trained in it by somebody who has years of experience. And so there is a level of performance in a pitch, in a presentation, in asking for investment, in going to get a buyer, in persuading an audience, and many of the things that need to be done, you may not even be aware of exist at this moment. And that's what those two books are about, is pulling back the curtain on what professionals do to win deals, start companies, raise money, and do all the things you read about in the newspaper and see on TV at the highest levels of business.
Well, and another takeaway that I had from it as well, though, is the quality of life. And that may not have been an overarching theme, but it is an underlying mantra throughout this, is that, look, if you're doing it wrong, you're taking too long. And if you're taking too long, then you're using up more of your life that should be spent on downtime, because we all need that to be that sort of professional gamesmanship, competitive monster that we need to be the pro and get the close. But if we're doing it and we're following this extended sales cycle, and you've seen it with the people that you've worked with, Oren, and that, and you've referred to it as the 10X paradox. I mean, we see people making these mistakes, banging their heads up against the wall, and therefore their life then becomes as dysfunctional as their sales prowess.
Yeah, I mean, I'll break it down for you in this way. In my view, is you can tell the difference between a pro and a Joe by the level of neediness, right, that they exhibit. Wanting the deal, needing the deal, being supplicative, you know, being a supplicant, pandering mm-hmm. to the buyer, to the investor, demonstrating both verbally, physically, emotionally, especially emotionally, and just by acquiescing that they need the deal. When you don't have the skills that you need, the deals that you get, you tend to need. The problem is, and then you communicate neediness, and neediness kills deals. When you're professional in this stuff, I mean, I'll cut off a deal. I'll work on a deal for a month. And then the guys will start to behave in a way that is not, in a way that's not acceptable to me. It's outside my value system. It's outside where I want to spend time, or starting to chew up time I want to spend with my family, or things I need to do for myself. Run, work out, write, sleep. So I have a lot of pulls on my time. I have a little boy, I have a family, I live here in Southern California, I'm involved in some organizations, I work out, here next door to me is SealFit, and I run. And so all those things I can't give up on for you, if you're not even my client, not even my investor, we're not even business together. I can't give up on going to a hockey game for my little boy, right? So that's inside my value system. So if you're supposed to sign a contract, if you're supposed to sign some documentation, if you're supposed to make a payment, if you're supposed to advance in some ways, sign a non-disclosure agreement, fill a data room with stuff, and you don't do it, and then I say, hey, we didn't get this stuff in the data room, we scheduled a couple of hours a day to go through your data so we could come back and give you a proposal or an offering, and you haven't done it, and then you don't do it again, I don't say please or thank you or you forgot or could we do it next week or when do you think you could do it? I say, listen, this behavior doesn't work. We fix this problem all the time. We help companies raise money. You need money. The reason you came to us is because you tried to do it and you failed. It didn't work for you. And then you tried to find some cheap solutions. You hired your nephew, just graduated from Stanford, and he couldn't do it. And then you went back and tried it again, and you also came up donuts. Then you showed up on our doorstep. We don't have this problem. We have all the money we need. You have the problem. I will not work harder on your company and your deal than you will. So listen, guys, if the data room isn't filled here by tomorrow morning, we're going to say goodbye to each other because this doesn't work. Okay? Now, that is not anger. That is not emotion. That is a certain part of a sales or customer acquisition process, which says if they won't play in the sandbox and you give them a couple opportunities to, you have to be able to let them go. When you push those companies away, 9 out of 10 times, they come back. You know, if you set something free and it really loved you, it whatever the expression is, the bird comes back, flies back to you and it really loved you, whatever. Forget about that for a moment. But if it's deals come back around, the neediness is what kills the deal. The non-neediness is what creates seriousness and stakes and let them know that you're performing at the professional level and they're performing at the substandard level and they want to come back up to your level of professionalism, your level of status, your level of values and be equal to you. And so the non-neediness and the strictness with the buyers and the investors is what brings them back around. Now, if you don't know what you're doing, non-neediness is very difficult to execute on. Basically, people who haven't been trained in this, the only way they come to non-neediness is from having a overwhelming amount of pipeline. So for example, anybody who's in PPE today, like, you know, personal protective equipment. So I know a number of companies who I worked with before the pandemic, before COVID. Crappy, small, little medical companies, right? And they would say things like, please and thank you, and we're looking for an account, and could you help us? And we'd like to grow, 5% over the next year. Then the pandemic hits, and everybody needs PPE. And now they're acting like professionals because they've been forced to become a professional because they're more people want to buy from them than they actually have product. And now they're acting in a way that if they could have before, they would have grown the same size business. They're like, hey, listen, we won't have any product available for the next 30 days. We're only taking orders above $1 million. I'm sorry, I have to put you in the pipeline. Hey, you missed a call. I had to put you, you know, to the back of the roster. You cannot miss calls with us. Otherwise, we have to take you off the list of approved vendors. Hey, listen, I know you want to buy product. I know we've worked you through before, but we have a new a buyer approval process. Until you fill in this documentation, until you meet our criteria, we're not allowing you to buy from us. So a crappy little company that was begging for business last year is now saying all the things that a professional would say, which is, I have to approve you before I let you buy from me. Yes, we like customers. Yes, we want to move our product, but we just very fortunate that we can choose who we work with, and we have not chosen to work with you yet. They get to say all those things because they have to. Now, the question is, can you come to that space and be not needy when you don't have the luxury of an overwhelming pipeline? And so these are things that professionals know how to do, and at least both my books and my media brings you to the ability. Even though you want a customer, you need the customer, it's critical to making your month, you say to them, listen, I like you. You guys look very interesting. I'm concerned about a couple things, right? I've still got to approve you as an investor or buyer for the company, and then I have to go to the CEO and see if we're willing to do a deal with you. And until you can say that to your buyer, you haven't really fully had the ability to do step one of deal making, which is eradicate neediness, right? And then, you know, there's another 7 things to do after that. But now you start to get an idea of what a professional will do. Raise the stakes, set a time constraint, reframe the competition as irrelevant. make sure the buyer understands that you're a peer. Make sure that the buyer knows that you what you do is very difficult. The other companies in the market, while they say they do the same thing, do it at a very light, L-I-T-E, level, and that you're one of the few people who really solve this problem, and that you're busy. And while the buyer, yes, is getting a presentation to evaluate you, at the same time, you're evaluating them. And when you can do all those things, you know, then you can get to a pro level.
Very good. You point out a silver lining now that I've never even thought of with the global pandemic. And that was one of my questions for you, though, but just actually being born a fire in that regard of, hey, this is it. This is all we have. We have to operate at this level, which then made them, again, I'll use the word, evolve to the place they need to be to eradicate the neediness in their pitches. Looking at the pandemic, Oren, has it changed other underlying sales principles that we've all relied on for the last decade, or is the effect of the pandemic a little bit more subtle than that?
Well, I think one of the effects is that a big way people knew that they wanted to work together was meeting in person. Because you'll see, even in the largest deals, when I talk to people, they'll say, you know, why did we end up here? In this part of the decision matrix, at this part of the decision tree. Why did you choose this company or that company? And let's say, you know, at the end of the day, the offers were very similar. They were 5% apart. We're not very price sensitive. And we liked those guys. We believed in them. And so I'll hear that a lot in $10 million, $30 million, $50 million deals. You know, we liked the guys and we went that way, even though their offer was not perfect. And so that came from really being together with people and seeing their value systems. And so Zoom or these remote meetings make it very difficult to establish what your value system is. And so the lack of architecture of how to really conduct a remote meeting and convey values and charisma and integrity and the nuances that are generally present when you get together with someone for a long period of time, how to convey those is lost. And so Zoom has caused people to become very sloppy. It's a medium people aren't familiar with, and major opportunities are being lost across the Zoom medium. Because, you know, and just tactically, it's like, oh, I'm sorry, I can't find the file. Or, hey, I'll be sorry we're late. I would say it this way. If the second word in your presentation is sorry, if the third word in your presentation is please, and the fifth paragraph or the fifth sentence in your presentation is thank you, I'm sorry, appreciate your patience, something has gone wrong. And so there's an entirely new skill set called remote presenting, right? We immediately recognized, just as an example, if you look at the studio that we pitch from now, I mean, this is probably $35,000, $40,000 of equipment, because we immediately realized, like, pitching from a laptop, having people look up your nose, in a quite unprofessional environment, immediately communicated low status, no money, minimum effort, trying to catch up organization. We want people, when we get on a call, on a pitch, to know that we are in a leadership position. We understand technology. We understand the constraints in the environment. We're taking a leadership position. In order to gain that leadership position, yeah, we had to write a $40,000 check and get some engineers in here and buy some equipment and understand lighting and move into a new pattern of pitching. So we have the correct lighting. We have we can do phone calls. We can do Zoom. We've got computer set up. We have engineers on standby. We have a Rode caster thing which can adjust levels. I'm speaking on a $1,000 mic. We have multiple camera angles. We're in a professional studio environment, and all that stuff is critical to the perception of, the quality of your deal. So, for example, we'll get on the phone and we look our side looks good, sounds good. We're organized. We know how to flip back and forth between a pitch deck and video. and the CEO of a $750 million company. The guy's worth $500 million himself. He's trying to, you know, raise $50 million. And he's talking with a laptop. There's a dog barking in the background. The phone, the connection is terrible. You know, we're looking up his nose. We could see, and it's a mess. And so I think that is just one very straightforward way that the environment has changed the requirements. It's taken away, hey, we just like those guys. We're going to be in business with them. And it's required you be much better at organizing the underlying technology in a pitch.
Well, we've talked about pitch anything. We've talked about flip the script, but you have so much more and so much more coming. Let's talk about what's next for Oren Klaff.
Yeah, so we're working on some. So I mean, flip the script, I think, is very critical for people to read. Pitch anything was about what's possible. The undercurrents, the mechanics of what's really happening in a meeting and in a pitch that's going to win it in your favor or lose it against you. And then flip the script came to the notion of, you know, 10 years later, which is if you believe, if you understand the things in pitch anything are possible, that you could say to a buyer, hey, listen, as much as you're evaluating us and you want to see a proposal and understand what we do, we're evaluating you. We haven't decided if we want to work with you, right? Once you see that's possible, the question is, how do you say, and flip the script gives you the scripts for saying those things specifically. Most importantly, I think that the two big things in flip the script, and I'll get to what's next, that's the baseline that you need to know is how to make the buyer understand that you and he are peers. He doesn't own you. He's not asking you for proposals. He's not deciding if he wants to, you know, he's not interviewing five different vendors and deciding maybe he'll work with you. That is not your process. Oh, you want to interview five vendors, have a bake-off? Goodbye. We don't do that. Oh, you need a proposal? We don't send proposals. You know who sends proposals? Companies who have nothing to do and are cranking out proposals all day long. Will we write a contract? Of course. About what? What are we doing? Right? What's the amount? What's the level of service? You know, what are the commitments? You know, let's get a letter of intent done. Let's get a definitive agreement. And will we send over a contract for you to review? But are we based on one conversation going to send over all of our pricing, all of our models, all of our information, and then you go shop that? No, but sure, we'll sign a contract. You know, so flip the script gives you the ability to say those things that I'm a peer and you don't own me. And secondly, it gives you the ability to put your ideas in the buyer's head in a way that they just stick there and they continue to sell while you're gone. And that's what I call inception. So then following that, the thing I'm working on now is the unlock code. The unlock code. And so if you think about it, Stuart, you know, let's say you and I want to start a company. What company should we start?
Let's do a podcasting company.
Podcasting company. Okay. So we have a podcasting company, and what it is you just record yourself talking to someone for half an hour, and our technology, our AI and our machine learning gets in there, and it finds the juiciest parts, and it boils down to 20% of the time for the juiciest parts and makes it sound like a podcast. That's our technology.
Okay.
So we need money because this technology, you know, we've done some coding and we're at the point where we have we figure out that it can work, but we need a couple million bucks. So we go to Sequoia, right? The venture capital firm, well known. On their homepage, they give you the template for how they want to be pitched, right? You download it. It's 11 slides. What's your mission? What's your vision? What's the team? What problem are you solving? What technology are you using? What's your timeline? How many users do you have so far? How much money do you need? What are you going to use the money for? And what are your key assumptions? What are your KPIs, your metrics? That's it. Anything else you put in that presentation doesn't belong there. That's why they give it to you. They don't want to sit through a two-hour presentation. They want you to go through those. So that's the unlock code for Sequoia. So we fill in dutifully their PowerPoint, their keynote presentation, and we take that to Sequoia and we pitch it to them and go, great, right? We like the presentation. You guys organized exactly what we asked you for. Here's $3 million. That's the unlock code. That information in that amount of detail in that order, given for that audience with those specific metrics, right? And that ROI gets you the outcome. So that's the unlock, the key, the unlock code that gets the $3 million from Sequoia. So now, because what we're doing is very scientifically advanced and forward, and we want to get some grants in the DOD and the National Institute of Science, NIS and DOD, give grants in the area that we're doing research, we're doing product. So Stuart and I go down to the Department of Defense, and we give the same presentation that just got us $3 million from Sequoia. We give the presentation, our vision, our mission, our team, what we've accomplished so far. And they stop us halfway through and they go, I'm sorry, what the fuck are you talking about? Mission, vision, we don't care about that. We care about science. Where's the science? You've been talking for 15 minutes, haven't heard a fucking thing about science. What do you think we do here? This is the Department of Defense, not the your local yoga studio. Vision. We're not trying to save the world here. We're trying to save America from criminals and terrorists. Get out of here. The wrong code.
Yep.
Right? So the unlock code is very different for them. We go, oh, okay, well, that's disturbing. Right? And then we go to Bank of America because we need to get a lease. Right? And now we've fixed our DOD, National Institute of Science pitch, and we blended that with the Sequoia pitch, and we've toned down mission and vision, and we go to Bank of America, and we need $1.5 million to get a lease. You know, now we've hired 20 people with the $3 million, and we give the pitch, and they say, I'm sorry, guys. I'm confused. Like, we don't understand science. We understand income statement, balance sheet, statement accounts, who's your accounting firm, you know, what are your account receivables, what's your debt to income ratios, what's your pro forma, what is your recent tax filing status, what's the, you know, where are you incorporated, what's the corporate status, and, you know, who's full-time, and are you current on your W-2 taxes? That's the pitch for Bank of America, right? And so that's the unlock code. So what is the unlock code for your buyers that you can consistently, Dan Day, just put that key in, type that code in, and boom, they buy or they invest. So that's what I'm working on now.
Outstanding, Oren. I love it. I mean, once again, know your audience, right? Know the buttons that they need to have pushed to get you back in front of them and close the deal. Oren, I've had a great time learning from you here today. I want to thank you for making so much time for us here in the Stock to Me podcast. Look forward to checking back in with you and seeing what else you've got cooking, my man. You have got so much going on, listeners. Like I said, it's just too much to give out. Google the man's name, Oren Klaus. That's the way to find out everything about him and all the websites. I would tell you right now, it is time well spent. Get those books. It's as easy as going to Amazon. Anybody's got them for sale. Best-selling author, Oren Klaus, but so much more than that. Oren, thanks for your time.
Stuart, thank you. Fantastic. It's very nice talking to you. And actually, I'm learning stuff just listening to the way you conduct a podcast. So I appreciate the two-way back and forth.
Well, that means a lot to me once again. For Oren Klaus, this is Stuart Smith saying thanks so much for listening.
The following Stock to Me podcast was an Investor Brand Network audio production. IBN is a financial news and publishing company delivering a new generation of corporate communication solutions, including news aggregation and syndication, social communication, and enhanced news release services. Investor Brand Network may receive payments for corporate communications relations as well as various press releases and social media solutions provided to its clients. IBN holds no shares of any company named on the IBN sites, brands, and/or podcasts. To be clear, all officers, directors, and independent contractors of Investor Brand Network hold zero positions in and do not trade or intend to trade the securities for their own accounts. This interview is not an offer or recommendation to buy or sell securities. Information in this broadcast is presented solely for informative purposes and is not intended to be or should it be construed as investment advice. As in all investments, investment in the featured company carries an investment risk. Listeners should review the company thoroughly with the registered investment advisor or registered stockbroker. This podcast audio interview by Investor Brand Network is not intended to be a complete study of the featured company or other companies mentioned. Information used and statements of fact have been obtained from featured company and other sources, but not verified nor guaranteed by Investor Brand Network as to completeness and accuracy. Such information is subject to change without notice. Please see our full disclaimers and disclosures at investorbrandnetwork.com.